I'm going to call this meeting to order. I don't think we have a quorum available yet, but I'd like to have Representative Gunther, Chair Gunther, present his bill. We're going to go a little bit out of order today and honor the chair and have his bills be heard first. So, Chair Gunther, would you like to present your bill?
Yeah. Madam Chairman, I'd like to move House File 675 to pass and be put in our, what? Huh? Layover for possible inclusion.
Okay. Proceed.
Okay. Members, Twin Cities Rise is a job training program, and I brought a former legislator and friend of mine and a very talented individual to give testimony for Twin Cities Rise. You're up.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Gunther. Thank you, members of the committee, for hearing our bill regarding Twin Cities Rise. With me, I have Art Berman, the CEO of Twin Cities Rise, who in a moment will give a brief overview of the bill that's in front of you and the program.
Could you introduce yourself for the record, please?
I'm sorry. Thank you, Representative McFarland. I'm Henry Van Dellen, representing Twin Cities Rise. I am a former member of the House. Pleased to be back in the company of all of you. And thank you for doing the job you do in a difficult year. And also, in addition to Art Berman, we have Tony Blakely, who's a graduate of the program, and Kevin Sanders, also a graduate of the program, and their stories will probably be more on point to the success of this accountable pay-for-performance job training program that's really one of a kind and a gem in our state here in the Twin Cities than anything else I could say. The graduates have the most compelling things to say. And just before I turn it over to Art, I want to say thanks again to Representative Gunther for carrying the bill. And also, off topic, I have to, as long as I have a public microphone, say what an honor it was to have the time to briefly serve with Ed Burdick, who passed away yesterday, and I'm a better person for having been in his presence for the years I was here. So I'll turn it over to Art to talk about the program.
Thanks, sure.
Thank you, Mr. Berman. If you could introduce yourself for the record.
Yes, thank you. My name is Art Berman. I'm the president and CEO of Twin Cities Rise. Thank you all for being here and for offering us this hearing. I'll do a quick overview of the program. Most of you know us, and then I'd like to turn it over to Kevin and to Tony, because they have the most compelling story here about Twin Cities Rise. As you know, we are an anti-poverty program. We provide work skills training and job placement services to adults in the Twin Cities living in deep generational poverty. The program provides hard skills training, life skills training, and coaching, and lasts between 12 and 18 months. It's very intense. It's very intentional. It's very much tied to success metrics around full-time living wage employment at the end of the program. We are, as Henry said, a very accountable model. We don't ask for grant funding. We actually ask for funding under a mechanism we call pay for performance, whereby we agree with the state on what the performance metrics are for success, a formula that works for the state from a return on investment perspective. We only get compensated or reimbursed under this program if we meet those success measures. If we do, the state realizes a very high return on investment. We estimate to be over 600% return on investment. And everybody benefits. We have successful participants. We have stronger communities. And state taxpayers have a very, very positive outcome. If we fail, we don't get paid. And it's as simple as that. So there's no risk in the state's perspective. And it holds us accountable to provide a strong level of service to our participants and to you as representatives of taxpayers of the state. So that's the 50,000-foot overview. At this point, what I'd like to do is turn it over to Kevin and Tony. And Kevin, I'm going to ask you first to just take us through 5 minutes to tell us your story.
Good evening. Good afternoon. Kevin Sanders. This program has been, it's meant a lot, just not just to me, but also to my wife and to my kids, and also to my sisters and brothers, because when I came into the program, I hadn't worked in over 4 years, and nobody would hire me because I didn't have a track record. And coming to Twin City Rise, things begin to change. They begin to show us how to change our states of mind on the inside so we can control things around us. Because before I came to the program, I can remember that having to put the burden of finances on my family, not being able to pay my house payments, car payments, it became a burden. I wasn't able to pay taxes to help our society, and I needed a chance. Not even the temporary companies would hire me, so I needed a place to go. And they took me in, put me back through school, paid for all of the schooling, and that made a great difference. I can still remember the first day when I went back home and told my wife after all those years her husband finally had a job, and able to tell my kids that daddy's going to come home with a check this time. Able to put food on my table made a difference. And that wasn't the only thing that helped, was that once I became employed and took over a department, I was able to bring interns in from Twin City Rise and begin to train them myself. And now those interns turn around and begin to get jobs. Like today, when I'm here, I need somebody to replace me. One of the men that's named Brian, who was an intern, has a full-time job, but he's off today, decided to come back to where I work at and take my place for the day. Because what we do as interns, once we get on a job, we stay in contact with one another. We help each other on the jobs. We help each other produce better out there. And at my company where I'm at, I think we've had like over 10 interns so far. And they come in and they help us with the program, because we help feed a lot of poor people, help them with housing, and we need the extra help. And without Twin City Rise training more people and sending them to us, I don't know what my program would do. And I don't know what I would be doing right now if it wasn't for this program. I would still be unemployed. I would still be relying on state for funding, and I wouldn't be able to stand on my own 2 feet as a man. So I'm very grateful for what they've done for me.
Thank you, Kevin. Tony?
Good afternoon. My name is Tony Blakey. I am a graduate of Twin Cities Rise and currently an employee of Twin Cities Rise. I'm very proud to say so. A little bit about me. Prior to going to Twin Cities Rise, I was in a state of being insecure, unsure, no confidence, and no direction. I spent time as a homeless individual. I spent time digging in trashes for food, being unsure of what my next move was, where I was going to lay my head. I can often recall actually spending time in a park across the street from my father's home, which was very demoralizing. I'd finally reached a point where I felt like enough was enough. I was sick and tired of being sick and tired. I grew up in this community of St. Paul, and it was very disheartening to have one bag strapped over my shoulder and walk the streets until nightfall, so that I could find a place to just sit and relax and get off of my feet. One thing I will also share with you before I go into how I came to know Twin Cities Rise is that there's a recreation center in St. Paul called Oxford. It's right across the street on Lexington from St. Paul Central High School. I spent many nights in this park wondering what my next move was going to be. There is a mural that still stands on the side of the building that was painted when I was a young kid playing football at the rec center. When the artist was putting up this mural, he told me that one of the characters or one of the young boys on the mural was me. So the many nights that I stood in this park, 12, 1 in the morning, with nowhere to go, I often looked at this mural and wondered what happened to that little boy. What happened to my life? Why am I standing in the middle of a park with no direction and nowhere to go? I'd gotten myself to a point where I was ready to just throw my hands up and say, I'm done with life. It's over. No one's going to give me an opportunity. I had contracted a felony. I was unhirable. And when I did get jobs, those jobs were taken from me, because once the background checks came back, The word was, I'm sorry, Mr. Blakey, but we're going to have to rescind our offer because of your background. So again, I found myself with nowhere to go and nothing to do, no way, no means of supporting my own self. Well, luckily, one day, someone introduced the name of Twin Cities Rise to me. And I can say to all of you right now that Twin Cities Rise truly saved my life. I didn't know if I was to the point of taking my own life, but I knew that something had to change, and change quickly. So I became a participant of Twin Cities Rise, and I became empowered. I learned all over that I was important, I was valuable, and that I was lovable, that my life was of significant consequence, that I had worth and meaning, and that I could be a productive member of society. Through Twin Cities Rise, I learned that if I truly put an effort in, I would get a great reward. Through the program, I was given an opportunity to intern at what was then called the Owali Place program, which was the all-male section of Twin Cities Rise. I was given the opportunity to intern at the front desk. In interning, I didn't really know where I was going to go from there, but I knew I wanted to do something. Twin Cities Rise then saw a little more in me than I saw in myself, and said, well, how would you like to actually work here for Twin Cities Rise? What? Are you kidding me? Absolutely. So I took the opportunity and took on the position at the front desk there at Twin Cities Rise. From there, I really started to learn what Twin Cities Rise was all about. And it was about helping people. Helping people help themselves. So I was given an opportunity to then become a coach in training. And from there, things really escalated. And I want to say that Twin Cities Rise gave me an opportunity to truly reach my highest potentials. In becoming a coach, I am now in a position to help individuals who are just like me. You know, even though I've overcome some of the obstacles that were put in my way, I'm still that homeless man. I'm still that felon. I'm still a man who is full of mistakes. But I use the experiences that I've had to give back to individuals who are now coming through this program. This program needs to be in existence. The support that it gets is very needed, and I truly hope that it continues. There are a lot of individuals who are out here just looking for a second chance. And as we think about this great country of ours, America, this is about second chances. Not all of us get it, but there are plenty of us who want it. And I just ask that, you know, there is continual support for this program because it does wonders. It takes people from rock bottom to achieving things they never thought that they would be able to achieve. I am living proof that second chances do work. I am living proof that lives can be turned around. That individuals who were once deemed as miscreants, if you will, can be truly productive members of society. Tax-paying members of society, individuals in position to give back and bring others up that have gone through some of the same things they've experienced. And I just want to, you know, say that Twin Cities Rise is truly a gem. It is truly a gem. It empowers individuals. It helps individuals to look within for solutions to their own problems. And it helps individuals, first and foremost, to build a strong and sturdy foundation, so that they can not only take care of themselves, but take care of their families, take care of their families. And I want to say, in a period of just over 2 years, I have gone from zero income to being able to stand on my own 2 feet, to having my own home, and just recently getting custody of my 14-year-old child. And it's because of the changes that I was able to take on by being a part of Twin Cities Rise. So I want to thank you all for your time and hope that you truly take into consideration the work that is being done at Twin Cities Rise, because it is truly, truly worthwhile. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. We do have a quorum now, so the meeting is officially started. Do we have any questions of members? Representative Sanders.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I had a couple questions. One, how many employees do you have? And then two, how many employers do you work with?
We have about 37 employees. in our two locations, Minneapolis and St. Paul. We work with several hundred employers, and I think all of you have our annual report, or if you don't, we can make those available. And we have a list of our employer relationships. Those relationships are not always all active all the time. It depends on hiring trends and so forth. But we are very proactively engaged with the employer community in the Twin Cities.
Anyone else? Well, thank you very much. Representative Gunther, would you like to finish?
I think this is a truly worthy program. It does something that many other programs don't even attempt to do. It coaches people to get skills to have a job and a productive life. So with that, I will lay this House File 675 over for possible inclusion.
Thank you. And Representative Gunther, we have House File 838 that is yours. Would you like to do that at this time?
That would be wonderful.
Thank you, Madam.
Chair Gunther, did you want to move that then? While we're waiting, would somebody like to move the minutes from the last meeting? Representative Scalzi?
Mr. Chair, I move the minutes from the last meeting. The minutes of, I don't see the date, but we know what it is. Thank you.
Okay. The minutes have been moved. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Thank you. Are you ready?
Madam Chairman, I will move House File 838 for possible inclusion.
Thank you.
No, for to be laid over. Excuse me. And with that, members, the OIC's opportunity industrialization sites train employees for the apprenticeable jobs. And they do a good job of getting people in livable wage jobs by going through an apprenticeship program in the OICs for various minorities. And we've heard about them a little before, but I certainly will ask the new director of the OICs to explain her bill.
You could you introduce yourself for the record, please?
I certainly will. Thank you very much. My name is Linda White. I am the board chair of the Minnesota OIC State Council. We testified before this committee, I want to say about a month ago, and at that time, our retired director was with me, William Means, and we now have a new state director who is Michael Yang, who is with us also today. I'm here to talk about the Minnesota Opportunities Industrialization Center, and thank you. Representative Gunther, as well as members of this committee. The Opportunities Industrialization Centers have been operating in Minnesota since 1967. The OIC State Council that I chair was incorporated in 1983. We are part of a national organization, OICs of America. It is a national network of employment and training programs. We're bound together by a common commitment to serve the unemployed. Our philosophy is centered on developing the whole person to become self-sufficient and productive workers. There are currently five OICs in Minnesota: American Indian OIC in Minneapolis, Anishinaabe OIC in Mille Lacs, Summit Academy OIC in North Minneapolis, Northwest Indian OIC in Bemidji, and the new Teocalli Te Kwioto OIC, which serves the Hispanic communities in St. Paul, Minneapolis, Owatonna, and Wilmer. The geographical areas that we serve are Aiken, Anoka, Beltrami, Cass, Itasca, Clearwater, Hubbard, Chisago, Crow Wing, Dakota, Hennepin, Candiohi, Mille Lacs, Ramsey, Scott, Steele, and Washington counties. What do we do?
Ms. White?
Yes.
In the essence of time, if you could avoid duplication from what we had in the last hearing, that would be great.
Okay. In the last hearing, we didn't specifically talk about some of the training services that we provide. We do training and certified nursing assistants and community health worker programs, adult basic ed, ESL classes, vocational training, small business ownership and self-employment, customer service skills and administrative assistance, computer skills, a lot of the IT work, and yes, we do pre-apprenticeship programs, carpentry, plumbing, electrician, sheet metal, welding, heavy equipment operating programs. But what we also do that makes us very effective is the soft skills training. That's career guidance and counseling, restorative justice, dress for success, team building and leadership, problem solving, and decision making. Also, we have summer youth internships, including ex-offender and offender training, MFIP, welfare to work, and Hispanic outreach. We have served in 2010, 2,438 clients. 2,193 are minorities. 972 are welfare recipients. We serve both adults and youth. Females and males. Females are at 1,536, 63%. Males at 902, 37%. While we do receive a combination of sources, funding sources, in 2009-2010, the OICs received $1,375,000 per year, $2.75 million for the biennium from the state, and we are truly grateful for that. A good percentage of our folks have entered employment. They have gone on to higher education and full technical and apprenticeship programs, and our average wage our starting rate wage for the full-time placements are $19,708. 15 completed their training. I want to lastly talk about the social impact. What we have given back is increased wages to the state, taxes paid and reduced public assistance, increased productivity and educational and life skills, improved parenting skills, and stronger families. When you take these into account, the public assistance, savings, taxes, wages, and benefits, and incarceration avoidance, there is a $16 return on every dollar investment that the state has given to the OIC programs. We know that you have a difficult decision in front of you, and we want to thank you and acknowledge your support in the past, and we do certainly hope that you will consider us this next go around for continued support.
Thank you, Ms. White. Anybody have any questions? Any members? Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I've got a couple of questions here. You talk about ABE training in your program. One of the things that I would like to see, and I'm sure I would probably get backing from members of the committee, is the stackability of your programs. Can you stack, you know, your ABE onto post-secondary education? Can you stack your nurse's training for a nurse's aide to an actual licensed nurse or registered or whatever the term is? Can you speak to that a little bit?
Sure.
Ms. White.
Thank you for the question. When you mean, when you say stackable, a lot of our students go on without any problems transfer to our vocational skills, St. Paul College, Minneapolis Community Technical College, and so on without any problems. So they are accepted there. We consider that a positive outcome when they're able to go on to higher education from the OIC program.
Representative Mahoney.
Thank you. And I didn't explain it very well, so I'll try it one more time. I'm a welder, and I know how to weld carbon steel, and that's a 3 or 4 month training at the facility that I go to. The next level of pipe welding that I would go back to get training on would be stainless steel. But if I have my carbon steel certification, I can go out and work for a month or 6 months or whatever, and then there's the availability at the particular school I'm going to that I could go back at nights or weekends to pick up the certification for stainless steel. Okay. Do you do anything like that?
All right. What I want to answer in that regard, Representative Malloy, is that our pre-apprenticeship programs in the various trades are to prepare those individuals in some of the soft skills, as well as working with them to hopefully get accepted into the union as well, and so that they are ready and go on to the next step, whether that be at St. Paul College or Minneapolis Community Technical College, where we have partnerships, or Dunwoody, where they have partnerships. So they are all intended to go directly to the next step if they choose to do that and don't want to get right into a job.
And Madam Chair, if I could just
yes,
one more question.
Representative Mahoney.
In light of what the Senate did today with their targets, I think they released for their jobs committee, was it about a 40% cut? Pretty much across the board. What would a 40% cut do to your program?
A 40% cut in our program, because a lot of course, our money is passed through to the OIC centers themselves. I would guess that would be a tremendous impact and blow on our programs, because I don't know in the short term where we would be able to make that up. The funding that comes from the private sector, as well as you all may know, is shrinking and not available as it used to be. So there would be an impact for sure.
Any other questions? Representative Leidecker.
If it's okay, I just want to explore that private sector funding just for a moment. You say it's shrinking. Do you have a staff that goes after private funding? I mean, it seems like this is a great program, and that the private sector would want to fund. How many people do you have working on that?
At the State Council office, the administration consists of our director, an administrative assistant, and also some part-time accountant. In terms of the OICs, though, they have individual efforts to raise funds through the private sector. And in addition to the funding that we get from the state, we get probably a little bit more than that from the private sector, from a variety of funding.
Representative Leidecker.
So a little over 50% is, you know, it seems to me, we discussed this last time we were talking about this, how much you were getting from the private sector. So it's a little over 50% of your funding comes from that. Okay, thank you.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions? If not, Representative Gunther, do you want to renew your motion?
Madam Chairman, I'd like to lay House File 838 over for possible inclusion.
Thank you. With that, I think we're going to switch.
Yeah, you and I got it.
Thank you.
Representative McFarland, our wonderful committee administrator says we have quite a few bills, so we would ask for brevity if possible.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House File 729 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Very well.
Okay, Mr. Chair and members, House File 729 provides funding for the Bio Business Alliance of Minnesota, known as BBAM. We are asking to continue funding at the current level of $1.75 million for the biennium. Founded in 2005, BBAM grew out of the Governor Plenty's Bioscience Council. BBAM is a private-public partnership with a board of seasoned leaders representing the private sector, academia, and government. At the time of the founding of the alliance, critics in our state were saying that it was too late for the biosciences in Minnesota. The headlines called, "The train has already left the station." Well, fortunately, BBAM has been able to show that the critics were wrong. First, BBAM measured the reports and reported on our progress in the private biosciences marketplace for both employment and the economy. Second, Bio Business Alliance has created a statewide business plan called Destination 2025 to show where the bioscience resources are strongest, where we are weak, and how to improve. Finally, and most importantly, BBAM has worked with individual companies to connect them with resources to grow jobs in Minnesota. Today with me I have Dale Wallstrom, the President and CEO of the Bio Business Alliance of Minnesota. Mr. Wallstrom has spent 25 years at Medtronic and led the company's largest division. He chaired the Governor's Bioscience Council and took an early retirement to lead BBAM. Mr. Wallstrom is a native Minnesotan who shares my belief that the creation of a strong bioscience sector of our economy is essential to providing our grandchildren with the foundation we need for the future security of our state. The backbone of the foundation are innovative startup companies. After all, some of the state's largest companies started as small, high-risk ventures. Medtronic is an example, started in Earl Bakken's garage. And then I will introduce Mr. Wallstrom, and then he can introduce two business witnesses today.
Thank you, Representative McFarland. Mr. Chair, I would like to just open by saying that by thanking the committee and the subcommittee for their support over the past years, I'd also like to say that there is nothing I do in my day-to-day job that I dislike more than coming here and asking for money. This is the unfortunately due to the fact that the companies that we work with and the companies that we support are not in a position to fund. We go out and we collect funds and grants and whatnot from various private sector organizations, foundations, and the like. Whenever we go in to ask for those donations, and by the way, we match or better than match everything we get from the state. But when we go in and ask to a company or foundation ask for funding to do what we do, we run into basically the same comment every time, and that is that we love what you're doing. Is the state doing its share to support you? The general belief is that if the state doesn't care, then neither will we. Now, we know that that's not the case. We understand the difficult situation that the state is in. But it puts us in a position where we're back here again asking for support from the state to keep the work going. In our handout, there's a handout that you all have. There are a series of graphs that demonstrate to you where we do our work across the state and the type of projects that we do. I'm not going to go into any of that today. I'll simply say that the number of the jobs created as of December 2010 was 2,707. We know that number because we actually go out and poll the companies that we've supported to find out the hiring practices that they have had since we started working with them. And those companies are predicting another 2,186 jobs by 2013. In addition, they have brought in about $133 million worth of funding, most of it from outside of the state into Minnesota to support their growth. The cost per job created so far is somewhere around $4,000 per job. The cost to the state is a little bit less than $2,000. Rough ballpark number, we estimate that the taxes that these companies have paid, just in payroll taxes, nothing, no corporate tax, is somewhere around $9 million in 2010. And then in 2013, if they implement their plans, they will it'll be somewhere around $18 million. We're very proud of what we've accomplished. I'd like to be able to sit here and tell you that I can take full credit for that. I can assure you I cannot. We have surrounded ourselves with a group of very seasoned CEOs, CFOs, experienced business people, academic people who bring new knowledge to the market, and a group of staff that have become known as experts around the state in their specific areas of competency. And we bring those together, and they're the ones that actually make it happen. So for now, I'm going to stop talking. I'm going to turn it over. And first, we're going to ask Lisa Jansa, who is the CEO of Exelon, to tell her story. And then per protocol, and then Dennis McFadden from a CFO for a company called Ativa Medical to tell his story. And per protocol, I'll let them introduce themselves and a little bit about their company. Lisa?
If I could just have a quick break. We have some great guests I'd like to introduce from the back of the room. We have the ninth grade students from St. Louis Park High School, and they're participating in the Minnesota Historical Society Capital Historic Sites Voice of the People. So wave to us, and thanks for joining us. All right, and to the testifier, if you would introduce yourself for the record, that'd be great. And if you could keep your statements somewhat brief, that would be appreciated.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, thank you. My name is Lisa Jansa. I'm founder of two diabetes-related companies that are doing business in Minnesota. And I'm currently CEO of Exelon Corporation, which is a drug development company in clinical trials at Mayo Clinic, targeting a breakthrough therapy for people with diabetes. We're hoping to grow our business here in Minnesota. You can read more about who we are and what we're doing in a handout. I won't get into all the scientific background on that. If those of you that are interested could follow up with me at a later point. But I wanted to put it in perspective what this whole area of diabetes is about. One in four Minnesotans suffers from diabetes. You hear about it in the news all the time. Probably many of you have yourselves or family members that have diabetes. It was just announced that diabetes drugs are now take up one-fifth of the total expenditures for drugs, $52 billion. And Minnesota currently has less than 1% of that market. Of the 200 companies that are emerging companies in diabetes, I've worked through our consulting group that we formed about 8 years ago. We've worked with over half of those. And again, less than 1% of those companies are located here in Minnesota. However, there is a great deal of diabetes leadership, global leadership, and expertise in the state, and the BioBusiness Alliance has had a tremendous impact on that over the last couple of years. So today I'm here to request your sustained support of full funding for BioBusiness Alliance. I had the privilege to talk to the committee several years ago, shortly after the Destination 2025, which is a roadmap for the life sciences for the state, was publicized. And at that time, Exelon Corporation was just preparing to go into clinical trials, which, as I mentioned, we're now involved with at Mayo Clinic. And I was impressed about the vision that BioBusiness Alliance laid out and the vision and commitment to help emerging companies. And I, you know, really looking at that, I knew that Minnesota had unique assets in diabetes and that it wasn't leveraging those assets effectively, and that it really fit perfectly into what that roadmap and the vision that was being laid out. We wanted to be a catalyst company, and BioBusiness Alliance took the time and listened to our goals and our strategy. I'm here today because of that relationship, and in fact, it wasn't until we started working with the BioBusiness Alliance that we felt Minnesota had a real interest in our presence and our future growth in the state. They listened to our goals and supported our efforts efficiently and effectively. As an emerging company, this efficiency and effectiveness is the cornerstone of our relationship and has enhanced our commitment for remaining and growing in the state. Let me give you a couple of examples as to how BioBusiness has really made an impact. They provided us with directional networking of introductions that led to both collaboration and investment. They took the time to understand really what our strategic goals were and used my time very effectively. I don't have time to waste meeting people in general. I need to have very targeted introductions. They've helped the Minnesota Angel Tax Credit. Appreciate that came through. That helped us raise funds in 2010. And in July, some of you may be aware of the Diabetes Partnership Initiative that was launched, which featured introduction of a bigger vision for the state. It included Mayo Clinic and the University of Minnesota, but also leadership from the Native American community, the food industry, and emerging companies like Exelon. It was hosted at the International Diabetes Center, part of Park Nicollet, and attendance was more than double what was expected. It was inclusive of so many industry stakeholders that it would not have been possible without the leadership of BioBusiness Alliance. This event and the connections that were made there are still yielding benefits. Again, another recent example, in January, we traveled with BioBusiness leadership to Saudi Arabia to meet with clinical and business leaders interested in diabetes. This wasn't a general trade mission, but it was really on the basis we were selected because of the strategic interests in the region, and BioBusiness Alliance played a key role and helped screen and qualify so that we, again, were not wasting our time. As an entrepreneur, I understand that the importance of using funds wisely. And in my humble opinion, BioBusiness Alliance short track record and vision and progress and successes should be analyzed separately and distinctly from general economic development efforts. There's no one better positioned than BioBusiness Alliance to carry this vision forward to distinguish Minnesota and leverage the full potential of all of the state's life science assets and build a thriving and diverse industry cluster. Thank you.
All right, thank you. We have a question. Representative Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just had a question. One of the reasons for investing, of course, in some of these programs is to see what the return can be. And I've always had this question for the pharmaceutical investments. Can you tell me what we can expect the benefit in terms of lowered cost of diabetic medications and so on that you're working on will be to the consumer?
Well, in our particular case, you know, I think looking at the cost, really targeting an underlying cause of the disease, preventing the disease, is really what you're, you know, where the real breakthroughs are going to come from. And so if you can prevent that progression, prevent complications, that's where the real savings are magnified. So, you know, if you're doing just incremental new kinds of therapies for the same targets, you aren't going to get a lot of benefits. But when you're targeting the underlying cause and looking at preventative therapies, that then those cost savings are magnified.
Mr. Chairman?
Yeah. Representative Clark.
I agree with what you're saying. That's really the first part of the investment, and it's really important prevention. It's a very important public health principle. But what I'm talking about is, what do we know about what those drugs that you're producing, does our state investment help lower the cost, or are they still going to be very expensive drugs? Because, you know, these new pharmaceuticals, while they're still patented, are very, very expensive usually. So I'm just wondering if you can tell us, or maybe not.
Well, it's kind of a generalized question. I mean, I think, you know, looking at development efforts, it is a very costly pathway, regulatory. You know, it's a risky business to do drug development. What FDA requires today is only getting harder. As a society, we're very concerned about safety. That's always the first concern, safety and efficacy. And so how that plays out, I think as an economy, as a national leader in pharmaceuticals, for us to maintain that position, we have to be willing to bear the costs and the risk to do drug development. Otherwise, it is going to go to China, India, and other countries. It's just a fact of life.
Mr. Chairman,
Representative Clark.
I'll just end with this. I would appreciate if at some point in the future you could provide what the average cost of the new drugs are. Maybe that's a simpler way to talk about it. And you don't have to do that today because it sounds like you don't really have that data, but it's just a good thing for us to know. Like, you know, we're investing in here so that the drugs will be more affordable to Minnesotans, if
sure.
They will be.
All right. Representative Leidiger, did you have a question?
Yes, sir. Ms. Janza, I'm interested in hearing more about the relationship with BioBusiness. I really want to know more about the program. To start with, what percentage of their funding came from BioBusiness? When did you? In fact, I'll ask all the questions, and then she can just elaborate. What kind of funding? The other thing is, how did you initially get in touch with the organization? That I'm always interested in that in the marketing efforts that you do, and how do you get out into the community, and how do you connect with young companies like this and make it happen? Can you
talk to that a little bit, please?
Sure. My initial introduction happened to be through my local community. I live in Burnsville, and that's where we started. I met some of the economic development people there, and they said, we need to introduce you to the Biobusiness Alliance. And so that was how my initial connection. It happened to be right at the time they were publicizing the results of Destination 2025, which was the roadmap, and it was just perfect timing, as it turned out. To your second question, has Biobusiness Alliance provided any funding to us? No, that isn't their mission. They don't provide funding to us directly. What they have done, though, is invested in making introductions that are, you know, strategically intelligent. They took the time to understand who we were, what our goals were, so that when people, Dale Wallstrom and people from Biobusiness Alliance call and say, I think you need to meet so-and-so, I know that that's likely to be worth my time and effort. As an entrepreneur and a CEO of a small company, I'm all over the country, all over the world, looking for funds. It doesn't mean I have to be here in Minnesota looking for that. So when they take the time to find out a strategic connection, I know that it's likely to yield some benefits, and in fact, it has.
Thank you. I'm going to ask one more question. You went on a visit to Saudi Arabia. Where'd you go, Riyadh?
Yes.
Do they have problems with diabetes over there?
Huge problem.
They do.
Even higher than in the United States. There's nearly a third of their population now suffers from diabetes. That was one of the key things that Biobusiness Alliance was excellent at doing, is understanding, was that a high priority for Saudi Arabia? Because a company of our size would not have the bandwidth to realistically try and qualify and sort that out. So that was a key strategic relationship that they were able to cultivate and made it worth, very much worth our time to go.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you very much. My name is Dennis McFadden. I am the CFO and the Vice President of Corporate Development for Ativa Medical Corporation. It is an honor to be here today to speak on behalf of BBAM. It is a subject that is near and dear to our heart and to the hearts of many startup companies such as ours in the Minnesota area. Let me give you a little background on the company. We are located in St. Paul. We are developing the world's first blood test in a very portable manner that can address 25 of the primary blood diagnostic tests with a single drop of blood, provide you the results within about 3 to 5 minutes. Our toaster-sized instrument, which I will show you here in a moment, costs about $10,000 at market. And it can do the same tests as a portfolio of about 5 other systems that cost about $100,000 a piece. Our objective really is designed to bring technology to this market. It is designed to lower healthcare costs. It is designed to provide real-time results so that the physician can give you the diagnostic results right when you are with them, much like they do with blood pressure, much like they do with your other vital signs. This will be absolutely the first of its kind in the world, and we are told that not only by ourselves, but in fact by industry leaders such as Quest Diagnostics, Abbott Laboratories, Siemens, Roche, and a multitude of other leaders in the industry. We are building our company with strong Minnesota-based partnerships. The technology was really licensed from Honeywell, based in Golden Valley, Minnesota. 3M is our supplier of the materials that go into the cartridges. They're based in St. Paul. Lasix Industry is a small microfluidic fabrication house in White Bear Lake. They provide us the infrastructure for the cartridges. And Benchmark Industries does the electronics fabrication for our instruments in the Rochester area. So you can see that our connections are very strong and deep across the state of Minnesota. To give you a sense, to perform a test, one would simply take a drop of blood, such as much like a glucose meter, would slide it into the system. It would do its magic, if you will, and in about 3 to 5 minutes, the results would be displayed not only on the screen in front of you, but in fact would be electronically transmitted to the electronic medical records, thereby providing very rapid dissemination of that crucial diagnostic information. When it's done, you simply pull out the card, dispose it much like you would with any other Sharps container device. The company was conceived in 2005. Our founder, David Dietz, is a long-standing entrepreneur. He originally slotted this to be started in San Diego, California. Thanks to the efforts of BBAM, who are quite persuasive, including the gentleman to my right. He was persistent and pursued us so that we started the company in White Bear Lake, Minnesota. Originally started in a garage office, and we moved to the University Enterprise Labs offices in 2008. We currently have a team of 25 employees. These are highly skilled, highly trained technical people, many of whom have PhDs, advanced degrees across a variety of biology and electronics competencies. Most of them have been been educated at the University of Minnesota, St. Thomas, and St. Cloud State. And to date, we have been funded predominantly by angel investors that are primarily located in the Twin Cities area. While California and Massachusetts dominate the diagnostics industry, Minnesota is, in fact, an ideal location for development of a company such as ours. We are a hub for products and technology in the medical space. Our core technology and development partners are located nearby. We can readily get to Honeywell in Golden Valley or 3M in St. Paul within minutes. There is an available talent pool for all of the core competencies that we need, whether they be in biology, electronics, materials, you pick it, it is in the Minnesota area. There is a savvy, sophisticated, and well-organized angel investor community here. These are some of the reasons, but really why we're here today is the thing that is really crucial is the availability of an organization like BBAM. They are the ones that have fueled the collaboration that has created significant value. Lisa has, my colleague here, mentioned Saudi Arabia. I won't go into that further other than to say that that is not something, those aren't meetings that we would have otherwise been able to access without the benefit of our affiliation with BBAM. As to the return to the state of Minnesota, we currently have 25 employees. Excuse me. The average salary of that employee pool is about $85,000 a year. We expect to grow that pool to 120 employees within the next 5 to 6 years. The average salary will be approximately $80,000, and that will represent about an $11 million a year annual payroll. Our partners, which I mentioned previously, will have a similar number of employees that are dedicated to this project. In addition to that, we will spend millions of dollars in capital expenditures for the equipment that we need to fabricate this business, a majority of which will be obtained from Minnesota-based organizations. Let me summarize. Without BBAM, we wouldn't be here. They gave us access to prominent leaders in Saudi Arabia. They have made connections for us on behalf of the angel investment community, and we are building a base with their assistance that could conceivably become another medical device or medical product sector within the state of Minnesota. We believe they are an unsung treasure in Minnesota. I strongly encourage you to give them full funding for the next biennium, and I thank you so much for your time.
Question from Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I actually have a couple of questions, but is your product in the prototype stage at the present time, or is it on the market?
Mr. Chair and Representative, it is currently pre-FDA approval. We expect to gain FDA approval later in 2011. We expect to launch this globally beginning in the latter part of 2012.
Well, good luck with the FDA.
Thank you.
I was going to correct you, just scans a few recent remarks. I would have been much more reluctant to say you're in Maplewood, but now I'm not, unfortunately, St. 3M is in Maplewood, not St. Paul. But I do have a good spot for you. when you decide to expand out of UEL, which is at the present time, just for the members of the committee, almost 99% full and does not have any more room for small entrepreneurs like this gentleman, Beacon Bluff, an old site that 3M decided to move from over in St. Paul. And I'm sure the city of St. Paul will try to work helping you build something that would do that. Then I might actually be able to say, Dale, thanks for getting somebody over to my district. Here's my question, and I could speak. What?
I was just going to say, I loved it when he said white bear so many times during this.
Yeah, time. I know. I'm trying to get more of these people to say St. Paul.
actually, the office overlooks Lake Bald Eagle. Sorry.
Mr. Chair, I actually have a question for Mr. Wahlstrom, so if there's other questions for the witness, I'll hold up.
Okay. Representative Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my question was, as I'm a numbers person, I'm looking at the chart, and the base funding for BioBusiness Alliance this year was $475,000 out of the general fund. And the BioBusiness Alliance did get a non-state match of the like amount, which was not federal. So maybe you could let me know where that came from. And then the second part of my question would be, the governor's budget appears to me like a 25% reduction. Your bill has a blank for the funding that you're looking for, and assuming we go like the Senate with the 40% reduction, what would that do to maybe not your company because you're up and running, but other companies?
Mr. Chair and Representative, I think this would have a dramatic and negative impact. And although we are up and running, things like Saudi Arabia, we would not be seeing the Deputy Minister of Health in Saudi Arabia that controls 65% of the medical product flow into the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia without BBM. We would not have had the audience with the head of their equivalent of the Mayo Clinic, who desperately wants to establish a clinical research and development and manufacturing relationship with our company without it. And so while we're a little more seasoned from an entrepreneurial point of view and more mature as a company, we still rely very heavily on them. And this would have a dramatic impact, I think, across the entire portfolio of companies that work with BBM.
And Mr. Chair.
Representative Scalzi.
Just as a follow-up, and where does the other non-state match, and maybe this is to Representative McFarland, if it's not a federal match, what is that non-state match?
Mr. Wahlstrom can answer.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
The last biennium, our total contribution from the state was $1.75 million. A million of that came from a baseline item, and $750,000 came from it came through commerce. I'm not exactly sure the exact source of that, but it came through commerce. And that was a one-time payment, okay, versus base. So the million was the base, and that was converted to base last biennium. Did that answer your question?
I know. I'm wondering where the non-state match comes from.
Oh, sorry. Mr. Chair, it comes from foundations, companies, individuals, all private sector type organizations.
Thank you, Mr. Wahlstrom. Representative Mahoney, did you have a follow-up?
Yes. What I would ask, thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Wahlstrom, my question kind of started by Representative Scalzi. What would happen to your organization if you had a, with the 25% cut that the governor has, and what would happen if you had, I think it actually is a 45% cut in the Senate, across the board for jobs, a 45% cut in your funding?
Mr. Wahlstrom.
Okay, we will go away.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Mahoney.
When you say you would go away, does that mean your organization would, you'd lay your 5 or 25 employees off and you would stop helping companies like this?
Mr. Chair. Yes. I mean, I feel like I need to give the committee an explanation of this. With, if I can have a minute, I'll do that. Mr. Chair.
Yep. Mr. Wahlstrom.
Okay. I run businesses, right? Companies and businesses. And we try to run this operation like we run a business. So there are things called ratios, you know, salary to expense ratios. And if you have an employee that has a salary of $100, depending on what their function is, you need to give them X amount of money in order to be able to have them perform work. And if you can't have a ratio that allows them to be productive contributors, there's no need to have the employee because they end up with nothing to do. You know, you never know that because they make it look like they're working, but the reality is, human nature being what it is, you need a ratio. So we have looked at that ratio, and at the current level of projected funding, we cannot continue to operate and have a ratio that will allow us to contribute at a meaningful level. So a decision that has to be made is depending on what comes out of the process. Does it make economical sense for the state and for us to be able to continue to operate? And we don't mean that. We really don't want it to come across in any way other than just a statement of there has to be a logic behind what you do and what you invest in. When it reaches a point where you don't have critical mass, then you should consider whether an organization should continue to be viable or not. That's the point. Mr. Chair?
Thank you, Mr. Wallstrom. I think in the interest of time, we'll take one last question, and we can make it brief.
And it can be a delayed answer, too. I just couldn't quite keep up with the additional appropriations that you said you got from other places. So if you could provide that at another time, I think I heard $1.75 million from somewhere else. And so I just want to know what the total state investment is beyond this $475,000. So if you don't have to do that now, we can do that later.
Okay.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I also wanted to bring forth that there are packets at each of your desks with letters from various companies across the state that have been helped by the Bio Business Alliance. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'd like to renew my motion to lay House File 729 over for possible inclusion.
All right. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Swazinski is next in queue. That will be House File 670.
Hello, Chair Stensrud.
All right, Representative Swazinski.
Yes. Thank you for having us before your committee this morning, or this afternoon. I move House File 670 be heard by committee and recommend it to be laid over and included into the Jobs and Economic Development Omnibus Bill. House File 670 is a bill that appropriates funds to the Minnesota Inventors Congress, and I would like to introduce. I brought two testifiers on behalf of Minnesota Inventors Congress. Deb Hess, who is the executive director of Minnesota Inventors Congress, which is located in Redwood Falls, Minnesota, and Julie Rath, who is a big part of that organization as well. So, with that.
All right. Welcome to the committee. Just identify yourself for the record, and if you could keep your comments brief, that'd be great. We'll keep ourselves moving along.
Chair Stensrud and Jobs Committee, I am Julie Rath. I'm the treasurer for the Minnesota Inventors Congress. In the community of Redwood Falls, I'm the local economic developer and have worked with organizations and worked very closely with the Bio Business Alliance as well. Two of my companies actually went with them to Saudi Arabia. But another resource that we have locally in the community that benefits the whole state of Minnesota and outside the area as well is the Inventors Congress. And on a regular basis or daily basis, we provide technical assistance for entrepreneurs and inventors with ideas who don't know where to start. They've got this idea cooking in their garage, and what do I do next? And they often call myself as a local economic developer or some of the people in your communities as well or across the state. And the first person I refer them to if they have an IP question or where do I start is I call Deb over at the Inventors Congress. And we started as the Inventors Congress back in 1958. You all have a cover sheet, I believe, that's being passed out to you. The Inventors Resource Center is our day-to-day operation, and Deb is our executive director and provides technical assistance for this organization. And we feel that inventions create jobs, and because it just starts out with that little seed of hope and an idea that creates many opportunities that are currently being manufactured across the state of Minnesota in our communities. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to our director, Deb Hess.
Ms. Hess.
Thank you.
My name is Deb Hess, and I am from Redwood Falls, Minnesota, and we want to thank you for your support that you have provided Inventors and our organization for the past 26 years. Because of your commitment to helping inventors create jobs, we serve well over 2,000 inventors a year through the Resource Center. We are a unique organization in the country. There is nobody else that provides full-time, year-round staff to have access to help inventors network with those reliable resources. As Julie said, it started in 1958, and it was a group of farmers and businessmen who decided that a way to keep young kids in the community would be to bring in new ideas for manufacturers to produce in their communities and their businesses. So each year we host that event. We're hosting our 54th event this year. There's a packet at the back for you to take that has all of the handouts for this year, just a general flyer, the information packet for the registrations, and last year's show guide. So if you have constituents who have questions about inventing, about getting their idea into the marketplace, we're literally a phone call away, 1-800-INVENT-1. We host 18 different workshops where we bring in experts from throughout the country to teach the process. And these workshops alone add over $10,000 of in-kind services to our budget. These people do not charge us for their time, for their travel costs, for any part of their expenses to get there. It is literally the place that they come in the country to network with their fellow inventors and experts. Just reading three quick sentences from an inventor, a past inventor. He said, displaying my invention at the Inventors Congress gave me an affordable way to present my invention to the public for the first time. In doing so, I gained the confidence and knowledge to pursue manufacturing options and to begin developing a marketing strategy. The seminars provided by MIC helped guide me through which I perceived a shark-invested waters as I sought to capitalize my invention. The Little Bug stoves are manufactured in Stacy, Bemidji, and Roseau, Minnesota. The stainless steel blanks are cut in Stacy, and then they are formed, packaged, and shipped from Bemidji. And pouches for the stoves are manufactured in Roseau and help to provide economic opportunity for persons with disabilities. The success of Little Bug Enterprises supports other businesses besides manufacturing. I use the services of graphic designers, printers, web developers, accountants, law firms, and shippers, all of whom support the Minnesota economy. From not knowing a thing about invention or starting a business, I am now the CEO of an S-Corp. This is in large part thanks to the Minnesota Inventors Congress. There's a lot of other wording in his testimonial, but it just really tells the story. And this happens all year long. It isn't just the event. The year-round resource center is where we actually have that hands-on. We are literally 1.5 FTE. It's one full-time and one part-time person that does this work. And yesterday I was talking to an economic developer from the Boys Fort tribe, and he was in his Net Lake office, and an inventor was there with him, and they literally were trying to figure out what he needed to do next. He had hired an IP firm, was considering working with a company called Davison and Associates. And this company was just fined $10 million by the Federal Trade Commission for misleading inventors. What they do is promise some amazing successes and yet don't deliver, and I could go into a lot of statistics to show, but basically I'll take the top end of their contract and the bottom end. If they serve 538,000 inventors in the last 5 years, 14 of them made more money than what they paid in for the services, and 0.001% of their revenue was generated from the royalty agreements from those successful agreements. So 99.999% of their money is generated from the services. Representative Gunther remembers a few years back when we were passing our Inventors Act, and we need to follow up on that and do some little tweaking. we're hearing some other things are happening. But these companies prey on the fear, greed, and ego of an aspiring inventor because they honestly don't know what they need to know. They don't know what they don't know is one of my favorite phrases. So we help them by connecting them to those resources that are directly connected to the industries that their products are a part of. And it is purely networking. It is the information and resources that get the information to them so they can make good business decisions. This gentleman from the Net Lake, from the Boys Fort tribe, he had downloaded our toolkit, which is free for anybody on the internet. He actually read it twice. It's over 37 pages, and he read through it twice in one day, and then he called me and said, you know, I have a lot of people that I know that we need to start connecting you with. And it is because I was invited to the Minnesota Indian Business Alliance meeting that we made that connection. So again, having that ability to network and be in these different places is how you get the word out. typically 10% of the appropriation is for the Minnesota Student Inventors Congress, and that started in 1988. And so students across the state have the opportunity to use the inventing curriculum and then earn the opportunity to exhibit at our expo. And 4 years ago, we actually sat in one of the hearings and heard a legislator state that he remembers that back in his childhood, and it was one of the most exciting parts of his childhood that he remembers, was that opportunity to test market his invention in the grounds with the adults, and that whole experience of meeting somebody from the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office. So again, it's a unique opportunity that happens for children, and we work very hard at making it an exciting day for them, and they get to meet a lot of people who encourage them to be creative and innovative. Basically, one of the phrases that Julie coined a while ago, we are the eHarmony.com for inventors. You know, our job is to help match them up with the right resources.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Hess. If there are no further questions, Representative Swedinski?
Yes, and I would just like to reiterate the fact of the, really the true uniqueness of this organization. You know, when Deb mentioned the fact that there are really no other organizations that do this across the country. You know, regionally, I know there's a lot of folks that contact the office from South Dakota, Wisconsin, and throughout. And really, it's a pure option. You know, you hear a lot of the commercials on the radio talking about inventors, and that's what we're kind of talking about is some of the poor direction that happens to be out there. And I would just again renew my my motion to have House File 670 laid over to be included into the omnibus bill. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. Representative Murdoch. Oh, we got it.
I just like this while they're leaving. I just like to encourage any member that wants to go to the Inventors Congress to do so because it's a very educational, enlightening experience.
Chair. Representative Mahoney.
Does that mean you're paying the per diem from the committee, sir?
I don't have a committee budget yet, so I don't know if I have anything to pay yet.
Just try. I'm trying to help you out, brother.
That's what I like about you.
Okay. Representative Clark, we're going to go with your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. I'm bringing to you the Youth Build program, and the bill that's before you today is to modify the work experience part of the bill a little bit, and I do have an amendment the bill, and I'd like to just explain to you briefly about that. We had a hearing the other day where Youth Build was described to some degree, so I won't go through all that again, just except to remind you that this is a pre-apprenticeship program that serves youth throughout greater Minnesota, urban, rural, and suburban communities, always has since it was developed in the late 80s. And these are kids who are dropping out of high school, and they get into alternative or learning centers, alternative schools, and are doing a great job and succeed. And you'll get to hear a little bit from them about that. I think the thing that's pretty unique about Youth Build is that these folks, as compared to other youth programs, they're constructing housing and other kinds of structures. And what the amendment before you today, or what the bill before you today does, is it clarifies the part that we added last year dealing with community gardens to also include the word food security, and that's a way to make sure that some of the building that they can do can be in the whole area of greenhouses and that sort of thing. There is an amendment, Mr. Chairman, so in addition to moving 405 to be laid over, I'd like to do the amendment, if that's all right. And it's amendment H.O. 405A1.
All right.
And I can explain it.
I believe you need to move the bill first.
Yes. Okay. My motion is to move this for possible inclusion.
All right, very good.
Layover for possible inclusion. All right. And then secondly, I'd like to move the amendment.
All right, very good.
So does everybody have that? And basically what we're clarifying in this amendment is, in the past, Youth Build had also allowed the pre-apprenticeship program to train youth in the areas of technology and the medical field. And this was started back in 1999, was renewed in 2003. Medical field was in 2007. These are going forward, but this was in session law, so we want to put it in the statute so it's a permanent part of the opportunities for these youth. That's the amendment.
All
Chair, you got to vote on the amendment, don't you?
Ms. Newman would like to clarify.
Mr. Chair, Representative Clark, and members, the A1 amendment actually adds your language to the appropriation rider, so it doesn't codify it, but it it puts it on the appropriation.
Oh, is there?
So just so that's clear.
Okay, I guess I was hoping we would be codifying it. Can we not do that?
Mr. Chair and members, if you'll give me a minute or so, I can. Yeah. We can do that verbally if that's what you want to do.
I appreciate that, Mr. Chairman, because we have had, this is not the new language to the bill. We've had it before, but it expires when the session law expires, so I wanted to make sure we can make it ongoing. And there's several programs where these fields of pre-apprenticeship work is now going on anyway. So.
All right. We'll work on the language.
Mr. Chairman, maybe we'd like to hear some testimony from the folks that are here.
Yes. Okay. Representative, you want to introduce your guests or introduce yourselves and state your name for the record.
Hi, I'm Vang Cindy Vang. I'm Cindy Vang, and I thank you for letting me talk with Youth Build. Youth Build is a great program to help us students learn about doing hands-on activities. Deconstruction and construction is very good for us to know, because it will help us in the future if we have problems at our house and we can like just fix it on our own instead of having people come and help us. With Youth Build, we are concerned about environmental issues, so we try to salvage materials and reuse them as we're building, remodeling the houses.
Hi, my name is Isaiah Eugene Casanova Ivy. And I just wanted to talk about Youth Build and how it helps me so far. Being a junior and so close to going to college, I didn't have no idea what I was going to go to college for my major for until I started Youth Build. And it introduced me to a lot of things. So I engaged on learning more about it and things to do on the site like lead safety and sustainable building. So I took classes on that. And it showed me how to build. We build garages, remodel houses, start from the ground up, trusses and everything. And that's all.
Thank you.
Thank you. I just asked our witness here to come to talk a little bit about some of the work that we would be doing in terms of clarifying the whole food, community food project part of it.
All right. Yeah, please introduce yourself for the record.
Hello, I'm Christina Sweat. I'm the director of BICAP Youth Build from Bemidji, Minnesota. BICAP Youth Build has been in existence, I believe, about 20 years. I've been with the program 15. So we're pretty old up there. We are also part of the Rural and Tribal Coalition of National Youth Build. I believe that Karen wanted us to speak to some of the other enterprises that Youth Builds can and do have. I'm sure that you're all aware that we try and build low-income housing or somehow modify low-income housing for our communities, and that is still part of our outreach. However, with the changing times in Youth Build, we have also reached out to other areas for our young people. My Youth Build serves 16 to 24-year-olds, with the majority of them being on the high end of that. In my Youth Build in northern Minnesota, over 80% come to us from the court system. Unfortunately, fortunately enough, less than 2% reoffend. And we're pretty proud of that over the course of 15 years. We have a very strong partnership and coalition with those people. And what we all got together and saw, whether it was SEP or the courts or the youth services centers or social services up there, was that we needed to diversify and develop job ladders for our young people. Unfortunately, as the state of jobs, let's say, deteriorates for some, it can impact those that have certain obstacles in their ways even more. For instance, if you have a felony, if you have a history with the courts, even if you have decided to turn your life around, on background check, this becomes difficult. So what we have done is find a way to bring job placement through a ladder. One of those ladders can be health care, although in our state, if you're going to be licensed, having a felony can certainly work against you. We can also go with certifications in, as the young people alluded to, the construction, which would be the National Center for Construction Education and Research, or NERSER, as you see in your handouts, certifications, or PAC certifications, which is the National Home Builders Certification for pre-apprenticeship. Those help. It also helps to be certified in renters from a nationally organized group. It also helps to have financial certifications, which we do up there, because if you do not go into it that much in depth, they do not teach them how to repair their credit. Now, I'm getting back to my job ladder in the Whole Food. Last year, our youth build was the recipient of $5,000 from the USDA for their micro-enterprise projects. And we were among, I'd say, 7 or 8 rural youth builds in the United States to have this money. We were supposed to develop a micro-enterprise. Our youth build has always been agriculturally based, given where we live. Even those that live in inner city do a lot of wild ricing and harvesting of some of our great national resources. So what we did was we decided to go into a gardening, if you will, or greenhouse business. We have always had a community garden up there. Part of our youth build teaches them to preserve food. So for 8 years, we've had a youth build community garden. We also are the recipients, by the way, of quite a few deer from the Department of Forestry that people shoot and don't have a right to have, and they give them to us. We preserve some of that for our youth build lunches, but I need you to know that the majority of that deer was turned into jerky and through the Minnesota NICE program sent overseas to our servicemen by my youth builders. I like to teach them that there are others that might want what they have. At any rate, with our $5,000, we built a greenhouse. With that greenhouse, we took off and built and sold and potted and planted 500 tomato plants and 700 pepper plants. We became members of our farmers market co-op. We sold those plants. We also took the leftover plants, put them in our gardens, and were able to feed our youth build with it. At the end of the project, our youth builders, over and above what they spent, made a grand total of $25 in the state of Minnesota. However, they also learned microenterprise. They also had to finish an economics class in school. They also had to finish microenterprise through the Department of Agriculture. They know how to get a business license. They know how to present a business plan to a bank. They know all of the things and aspects of a small business. And this year, because they made their $25, the USDA gave us $10,000 for another microenterprise. And they were very happy with the success of this one, because with that $25, we were the only youth build in the United States to make a profit. $25 sounds better then.
Representative Clark, and we do have updated language for your amendment.
Thank you so much. And maybe I'll ask. Okay.
All right.
Can we hear the language? That would be great.
All right. Here, Ms. Newman.
Mr. Chair and members, the amendment would be an oral amendment, so it would be in place of the A1. The amendment would be on page 1, line 18, after the word projects, strike the or, and then on page 1, line 20, before the period, insert semicolon or clause 5, pre-apprenticeship activities focusing on careers in technology or the medical field.
Thank you.
All right. Representative
Mr. Chairman, I would move that change to the language as an amendment.
All right. So we'll move the amendment day one. Be adopted. All those in favor, say aye.
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 All those opposed? Okay. And motion passes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the staff helping me do what we were trying to do. Thank you so much.
All right. Representative Clark,
I think we're, do we, are we about out of time? I'm not quite sure where we are.
Yep, we
okay,
are.
Okay. Well, let me just say we have people here who could talk about the other work that they're doing in other parts of the Youth Build Project, including some of your districts. You know, this goes from the Arrowhead to Scott Carver County to, you know, all over the area. And one of the reasons for putting some of the language in is to make sure that we're covering some of the work that's being done in the in that in those projects. And I guess if our time is up, I'm just going to thank the people who have come from the east side, from Scott Carver, and unless there's any other questions.
All right.
Sounds like we need to wind up. Is that right?
Yeah. Thank you, Representative Clark. Thank you, testifiers. We do have a couple of questions. Representative Lemire.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Clark, I see you're asking for $2 million in fiscal year 12 and $2 million in fiscal year 2013. I don't have my book here to tell me how much you received in the past biennium. Could you tell me what you...
Yes, I'd be happy to tell you. Thank you for that question. This is doubling the amount that the Youth Build Program has received in the past, $1 million each year to $2 million. The reason being there are long waiting lists, and that these particular projects are such a great investment in these youth. Again, I pointed out it's contrary to some of the other youth programs. These are pre-apprenticeship programs that fit into the whole area of job training, and these folks are ending up with certifications. They're also raising, like, for the $1 million, I believe they raised another $3 or $4 million. Was it $4 million? A little over $3 million. They bring in many more private dollars than the state gives them, and we know that with the long waiting list that they will do that again with the other areas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My only concern with this in doubling the revenues asked is, you know, like Representative Mahoney was saying, that cuts to the other organizations could cripple them too. So I just wanted to let everyone know about the concerns on that end.
Thank you. It's a good question. We're trying to be hopeful.
All righty. Representative Leidinger.
Representative Clark, wanted to know, how do you match, how do the companies get involved? Like, I went out, as you know, to the medical center. Great program out there, I thought. How does that money come in? The private sector, they matched the dollars that you allotted, that the program allotted to that particular activity. Can you tell me what that was? We didn't get into that when we were out there.
We have people from two programs who could give you a brief explanation of that, and we'll start.
Okay, if you could do that, I'd appreciate it.
Okay.
Thank you. My name is Joyce Eisinger. I'm from the Carver Scott Educational Cooperative in Chaska, Minnesota.
All right, and thank you. If you could keep your comments somewhat brief and to the point, it would be helpful.
I can do that. In our case at Ridgeview Medical Center, their matching dollars come to us in the form of supervision for students, because we don't have staff on that site, and primarily in training, because we don't do training in the medical profession. They end up training all of our staff.
Are these in?
Representative Leidinger.
Thank you, sir. Are the in-kind dollars?
Yes.
Is that what these are?
Yes.
Okay.
I'm Milo Cutter with City Academy in St. Paul, and we've been a youth build site since 1993. And over the years, we build partnerships. Sometimes we're the general contractor on the site, and we work with other companies to leverage our youth build dollars to complete projects. So over the 19 years, our youth build dollars, which are at $90,000 a year right now, have leveraged over $7 million in housing for the low income in St. Paul.
Right.
In addition, we're a school site as well, so we're using our education dollars and integrating the Youth Build program into our curriculum.
Right. Representative Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I just want to remind the committee that this is a 100% increase in their ask, and it's not general fund dollars, it's workforce development fund dollars. So you just have to always remember that these are taxes on employers. And employers are struggling out there right now. It's not like employers have lots of money to free up for this kind of thing. It's a wonderful program. I'm not saying anything about the program. I'm just saying if it's a general population purpose, it should be borne by the general population and not just by employers.
point. Well, again, thank you, Representative Scalzi. Representative Clark renews your motion.
Well, that'll be
an ongoing
discussion, I guess, for all of our workforce dollars expenditures. You bet. Thank you. Unless there's any other questions, I appreciate the opportunity to present the bill and okay. appreciate the amendment we put on.
All right. Representative Clark renews her motion to lay this over for possible inclusion. All right.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members.
Representative Murdoch. What number is it? All right. Representative Murdoch, I will move that House File 342 be moved for consideration of and House Ways and Means.
That'd be correct. Thank
all
you.
All right. And Representative Murdoch, lead us on.
Okay, Mr. Chair, members, I have an A2 amendment that I'd like to
in here.
Get passed here to get the bill in the form that that we need it. And I also have an oral amendment I'd like to incorporate into the bill, if we could.
All right.
Line 4.16 of the bill.
All right. I will move the A2 amendment.
Oh, thank you. Mr. Chair, thank you. Line 4.16, strike permitting authority and reinstate department.
Strike.
Yes, and that request came from the department.
All right. I will move that. Representative Murdoch, you can include that in your A2 amendment, and would you like some discussion on that amendment?
No, just a vote. Mr. Chair, just a vote.
Yeah, are there any questions? All right. Let's vote on the A2 amendment. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed?
Okay, thank you, members. Mr. Chair, House File 342 was brought to my attention last summer by Mr. Bruner from the Manufactured Home Association, and it deals with the inspection process on manufactured homes. Department of Labor and Industry was proposing to charge homeowners $2,000 to come from St. Paul, come up to Perham, and inspect a manufactured home. And that would go right to the bottom line of the price of the house. So we put our heads together, and Mark and Reed LeBeau and myself met with the commissioner and everybody in my office a couple times, and they've worked with them. And what we came up with was a process where we're going to local control. Let the local inspectors, housing inspectors, go out in the countryside and inspect the manufactured homes. So that's the gist of it. Mark can explain a little more detail as to what the bill, really does. That's the gist of it.
Please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chairman, Mark Bruner with the Minnesota Manufactured Housing Association. We represent as an association about 400 members, businesses, and are essentially the umbrella organization for the industry. We have 8 plants that currently build manufactured and modular homes. 8 plants that build modular homes in Minnesota. 4 of the 8 also build manufactured homes in Minnesota. The manufactured homes are built to a federal building code. Modular homes are built to the state building code, but they may be built in the same plant. And the Minnesota Department of Labor and Industry administers the federal building code for the for HUD. And it is a part of that responsibility. They need to go out and inspect all manufactured homes that are installed to make sure they're installed according to or put on a basement or foundation system in accordance with the federal building code. And that has to happen in non-code areas in Minnesota as well as code areas. In the code areas of Minnesota, the local building officials right now take care of the manufactured home inspections. In the non-code areas of Minnesota, which is where most of our manufactured homes are sold and installed, it's the Department of Labor and Industry that would go out and take care of those inspections. In 2006, I think we built about and installed maybe 4,000 new manufactured homes in Minnesota. The department projects that this year and next year, that number will probably only be about 500 homes. And as a result of that, the ability for the department to do those inspections in greater Minnesota when you have so fewer homes suddenly became much more costly to drive outside International Falls from St. Paul, that kind of thing, hence the reason for the proposed fee increase that Representative Murdoch had mentioned. But one of the things that we've suggested to the department and they do support is simply allowing local building officials who are currently doing manufactured home inspections in their municipalities to travel a few miles outside of the municipality to literally do the same inspection in a way that allows that would allow the department to continue to administer the federal program rather than have to drop it because they can't afford to do those inspections. That's essentially sort of the heart of the bill. It does make some other changes to inspections and a foundation system, but essentially the way it would work is that if you were in greater Minnesota in a non-code area and you had your new manufactured home installed and you'd inspect it, you'd go to the nearest or to a local building official, take your plans, that kind of thing, get your approvals done there. They'd come out and do the inspections. And otherwise, everything else would pretty much work just the same.
Thank you, Mr. Bruner. Question from Representative Swadzinski.
Thank you, Chair Stensrud. Representative Murdoch, are there going to be cost savings with this generally, or how do those things, is there a fiscal note on this bill at all, or what are we looking at here?
Well, it'll be an overall savings to the state. Mark can probably explain it. It might be revenue neutral or else a savings to the state. I believe the one right there is going to change. That one's going to change. That shows $206,000 per year savings. So I'm not ready to bring out the little Geico thing here to tell you exactly how much money we're saving. But anyway, that will change, and we could probably address that in ways and means as far as the fiscal note.
All right. Representative Clark.
Two questions. First of all, is the department here and willing to tell us what they think of this bill?
Representative Murdoch?
John is right here.
Mr. Chairman, I'm John Rakuski with the Department of Labor and Industry. Representative Clark, we've been meeting with the industry. We started meeting with them last October, and we have worked with them every step of the way. And so the language that's reflected here is agreed with upon by the department.
Okay. Mr. Chair.
Representative Clark.
So I guess, and I don't know if this is for the author or for you, but I see that there is a commissioner's fee here and that it has something to do with a final inspection. So is there still some responsibility the state is taking for ensuring that these are properly constructed and have the proper, whatever they're inspecting for all the various parts? Is there still a state responsibility here? And if so, what is it?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Clark, the answer to your question is yes, we will. I'll be completely upfront with you. I've missed the last meeting, so I'm going to turn that question over to Mr. Bruner.
Okay.
I know it has something to do with our seal.
Mr. Bruner?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Clark. Yes, the department will continue to receive the $80 seal fee that they currently assess. And what that means is that when the manufactured home is inspected after it's installed and it complies, then essentially a seal goes on the home to indicate that the home does meet the code and that it's been inspected. And overall, currently the department is responsible for making sure that when a local building official inspect some manufactured homes to audit, you know, randomly audit, make sure those are being done. That will continue. So everything remains in place in terms of the department's ability to monitor and audit inspections.
Right. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And in line with Representative Clark's question, I'm wondering, are we covering the administrative costs of a Dolly? And if we're subsidizing with construction code costs, should there be an increase in the fee in the future so that we can cover those administrative costs and not have to use construction code money to do that?
Dr. Bruner?
Mr. Chairman, the way the program, I understand, works is that the fees for doing the inspections essentially now are you know, they are required to cover the costs, and essentially there'll be fewer costs for the department now because they won't be doing those inspections in Greater Minnesota. A municipality will have the authority to do it. Their fees will be the fees that they currently charge for those inspections in the code area, plus any travel time, travel expenses. So essentially the department will still be getting their $80. And they also receive, and it's not reflected in the fiscal note because the fiscal note was drafted under the assumption that the state would no longer be participating in the federal program and receiving federal money. The commissioner and his team have determined that they will, with this legislation, be able to continue that. So they will be able to receive the federal HUD money, program money as well. That's not reflected in the fiscal note.
Representative Scalzi.
And just as a follow-up, so then the Dolly's administrative costs are covered, is what you're saying. That was my question.
Mr. Bruner. Or?
I'll take that.
Sure.
Yes, we've... the fiscal note will reflect our administrative costs, and it is a reduction.
All righty. Further questions? Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to any of the three at the table, I say I'm getting confused here. Is there a fee going to be of some sort in this bill? Mr. Bruner and then Mr. Rakowski, just to get both of you's take on it.
All right.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mahoney. Yes, the fee that will be in the bill is the current fee of $80 that will be paid to the department for essentially administering the seal and any additional audit work. And then the other fees would be the actual inspection fee, plan review fee that would be handled by the local building official that's currently doing that in their code area. So those fees would then still be the department. Let me back up. Aside from the $80, if somebody right now applies for an inspection for their manufacturing through the department, there would be some additional fees than the $80 relative to the time spent by the department to do a plan review, that kind of thing, before they went out and did the inspection. So those fees will still continue, but it'll be handled by the municipality.
I'd like, just to interrupt, I think Ms. Newman could help clarify this on the amendment.
Mr. Chair and Representative Mahoney and Representative Clark, I think part of the confusion is the commissioner's fee that's in the bill was amended out in Representative Murdoch's amendment. So the page 5, sections 5, 6, and 7 of the bill are deleted in the amendment, so that extra language on the commissioner's fee is no longer in the bill.
So, Mr. Chair.
Representative Mahoney.
So then there's no fees in here other than those that are already in place because, and here's where I'm trying to find this out. Having spent 45 minutes in taxes this morning with they consider gentle, and I'm going, boy, I'm glad I'm done with this. I understand that all fees are supposed to go to taxes. So if you have a fee change in here, and I want everyone to realize, not only am I signed on this bill, I sat down with the participants and have supported this bill, you know, as it moved forward. I thought it was a good idea. But I know anything with a fee is supposed to go to taxes. So that's why I'm trying to find out if there's a fee in this bill whether it's a current fee or reaffirmation of the fee, it probably needs to go to taxes. And whether it's going from here or from Ways and Means, I'm not sure which way it's supposed to go at this point. But if it's got a fee in it, it's a fee is the same as a tax if you look at the statute books about from 4 or 5 years ago. So someone tell me if there's a fee, because if there's a fee in here, I'm going to make the motion that it go to taxes. Mr. Soderberg, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, members, I think that what this does is it continues the fee that currently exists. So there's no new fee for the $80 inspection tag, or seal, I guess would be a better word to put it. And beyond that, it says that the inspections that are now done by the state will be authorized to be done locally. And instead of paying the state the money, if you have someone local do it, you will pay the same dollars that you would have paid the state to the locals. So there is no new fee. The only difference is that the fiscal note will reflect the state not receiving those dollars they used to get under current law, or the dollars they get under current law when they did the inspection. Mm-hmm. So it moves it from the state to the local, as does the money.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Mahoney.
In recognition of we're already over, I will stop trying to figure out the fee. It's a good bill. I think it does serve a good purpose on the state. I will have a conversation with our lead on Ways and Means if that's where it's going. Because if it's got some kind of fee or some kind of change in the cost, it probably has to go to taxes.
All right. Thank you. Quick question from Representative Clark.
I do know that we're over time, too, but I understand. So apparently the dispute resolution has been removed from this bill, too, so I am concerned about what's happening with that. And the last thing is, does this mean that we're going to be laying off some state employees?
Mr. Rakowski.
Mr. Chair and Representative Clark, that unit, if you will see a reduction in its workforce, but my understanding is those two individuals will be reassigned to other duties within the Construction Code and Licensing Division. So they aren't laid off, but the unit will reflect the fact that they'll be doing less work. There'll be two fewer people in that unit, but they'll be reassigned.
And the dispute resolution, we can talk about later, I guess. Concerned that there's not a dispute resolution in there anymore.
No, Mr. Chairman, Representative Clark. The reason that the dispute resolution provision was put in the bill is that when it was drafted, the department, prior to Commissioner Peterson coming on board, the department's intent was to no longer administer the federal program. The federal program has a dispute resolution requirement in it, which Minnesota has been administering for several years. What the bill did was essentially take what we didn't think was going to no longer be a dispute resolution program and move it into the new program that the legislature passed last year, requiring dispute resolution for residential contractors. And so our intent was to do dispute resolution, but under that program, okay, rather than not have one. So it
thank
will
you for explaining that.
All right.
Appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Bruner. So I'll renew a motion that House File 342 pass as amended and go to Ways and Means. All those in favor, say aye.
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 All those opposed?
Thank you, members, and thank you, Mr. Chair.
We are adjourned.
Sure.